Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Brian Gottlob. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. Frankly, there's not much going on in Washington on the issue of fiscal or budget policy as a result of the partial government shutdown, which is now the longest in American history, spanning more than a month and having no end in sight. In an attempt to break the stalemate, last week President Trump suggested linking $5 billion in wall funding with extending protections for deferred action for childhood arrivals, more commonly known as DACA, for 3 years, as well as a 3-year extension of protections for temporary protected status holders. Democratic leaders rejected the proposal. Instead, they are holding firm on their demand that the president reopen the government by supporting the previously agreed-upon spending bills that remain to be passed for fiscal year 2019 and discuss funding the wall only once those bills are signed. In the House, Democrats may propose adding $1 billion in funding for border security in a bill to reopen the government. However, none of that money will be eligible for use in constructing a border wall. The legislation will be the 10th bill to reopen the government since Democrats took control of the House in January, though none have made much headway, as Senate leadership has made it clear that no bill will be brought to a vote without the support of the president. Meanwhile, furloughed workers are being ordered to return to work without pay. Agencies where furloughed workers have been told to return include the IRS, Agricultural Department, and Federal Aviation Administration. Under the Anti-Deficiency Act, federal employees at agencies with funding lapses can perform work only if it is necessary to protect human life and property or it is otherwise authorized by law, such as activities supported by multi-year appropriations. Last week, the Treasury Department and IRS released final regulations on a new deduction for non-corporate businesses under the 2017 tax law, 2 weeks before the start of tax filing season. The 2017 tax cut allowed for a 20% deduction of income of non-corporate businesses known as pass-throughs. These businesses are taxed through the individual tax code, and the cut reduces pass-through business tax rates to their lowest levels in 80 years. Up next, I'll be joined by economist Brian Gottlob to discuss New Hampshire demographics, the impact of the recent federal tax code overhaul, and growing budget deficits during a time of economic growth. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Brian Gottlob. Brian is the principal of Poll Econ Research, an economic research firm in New Hampshire that specializes in identifying, understanding, and communicating emerging economic, fiscal, demographic, energy, labor market, real estate, and public policy trends. Welcome to Facing the Future, Brian.
Thanks, Chase. Happy to be here.
Certainly happy to have you on Facing the Future. In fact, over the last several months, I've been keeping an eye on some of the things you've been writing about, and they piqued my interest, which is why I wanted to have you on the show today. Some of those issues included demographic trends in New Hampshire, federal budget deficits during a time of economic growth for our country, as well as some economic feedback and revenue feedback from the 2017 tax cut. But before we dive into that, maybe give our listeners a little bit of background on yourself. Sure. And what you do with Poll Econ Research.
Sure. Yeah, I have undergraduate degrees in economics and master's degree in public administration with a concentration in fiscal policy. For many years was the vice president for fiscal and economic policy at the Business and Industry Association of New Hampshire. Did a brief 1-year stint in state government. Got a taste of what it was like to be in the bureaucracy. And for the last 17 years, actually, I have run Polycon Research, which is, as you mentioned, it's an economic consulting firm headquartered in Dover, work on a lot of different issues, mostly related to public policies.
Let's dive into the demographics piece for New Hampshire. The headline for the piece that you wrote was, New Hampshire never really lost its attractiveness. You called New Hampshire's demographic trends one of the most misunderstood issues.
Right.
Maybe give a little bit of background on that. Why did you make such a broad sweeping judgment on that demographic trend?
Yeah, well, I think I have for the last decade been fighting what I consider a misunderstanding of New Hampshire's demographic trends. We've got some issues like a lot of states and most of the country in that we're an aging society. And that's generally what happens when you have advanced economies, generally lower rates of births, and population tends to age. In New Hampshire, beginning about a little over a decade ago, mid-2000s, something fundamentally changed in the state. We stopped seeing large numbers of people moving into the state as opposed to moving out. So the net movement of people into the state all of a sudden started trending dramatically downward, and we actually started seeing more people leave the state than move into it, which is absolutely critical for New Hampshire because we grow and we have grown our economy largely by having a lot of people from the Northeast primarily move into New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. We're kind of the beacon of keeping people from the rest of the Northeast leaving to the South and the West. That's the demographic trend. People are moving to the South and to the Southwest. So around 2005 or so, we started seeing some out-migration a lot to the consternation of policymakers and some what I would consider, well, inaccurate characterizations of that. Things like all of our young people are leaving the state. Only old people are moving into the state, none of which is particularly true. There's elements of truth. New Hampshire has always lost young people, like every rural state. Young people move to places where there's a lot of other young people, urban areas. That's happened for decades. That's not what changed. And we've never seen an influx of older people. We always lose older citizens to warmer climates. What changed is the fact that we weren't seeing the movement of people into New Hampshire that we typically see. Early career people, two-wage earner, married couple, family with kids. That's kind of the key demographic who we would attract. Why did they stop coming here? Well, because things were really different beginning in the mid-2000s. We had the Great Recession, which made it very difficult to find new opportunities. Also, when you think about who moved into New Hampshire, people, two-wage earner, married couple, family with kids, probably owned a house somewhere else, would have had to sell it. Not an easy thing to do during the Great Recession. And they also probably would have wanted to buy a house in New Hampshire. Also not easy because of credit conditions. You put that all together, and the core group of people who were moving into our state weren't moving into the same level. What did that do? Well, other key aspect of New Hampshire's demographic, we have very low birth rates, really low birth rates, the lowest or second lowest in the nation, depending on which year. We have well-educated women who participate in the labor force to very high degrees, and that's a recipe for low birth rates. So we weren't adding population by birth. People who were moving into the state weren't moving in to the same level. And what happened is when that happens, your population ages much more rapidly. We kept our population from aging rapidly by having a lot of people move in at the middle. That means we're never going to be a really young state like Utah, where there's very high birth rates. But it also meant that we were going to age faster. So those things all happened. But the characterization was something was wrong with New Hampshire. My God, nobody wants to come here anymore. All of a sudden, our politics have changed. We're no longer attractive. Businesses don't want to be here, none of which I ever believed was true.
Taking that line of thought, Brian, if the issue was largely maybe a collapse of the housing market and the Great Recession and the sort of pulling away from that younger couple moving into the state, if that declined, I think we're seeing an increase in that now. Right. I saw reports recently that the last couple of years there has been an influx of young professionals moving into the state.
Yep.
Do you think the cause of that is simply a rebound after the Great Recession, or is there something, I think you mentioned in that piece that there has been some local policy changes in different communities that are becoming more attractive to that same demographic. In your mind, what is the recipe that has helped bring that back?
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. We a couple of things have happened. We're starting overall to see more people moving into New Hampshire than moving out. So, and it's accelerating. So it started small a few years ago, and now it's building. So we're getting more people moving in. The other key aspect of that is we're starting to see the age grouping of that movement into the state to move down a little bit. So we're getting more 25 to 29-year-olds as opposed to just the 30 to 44, which was kind of our key in-migrant demographic. And as you said, it's really concentrated, though. It's not spread throughout the state. So there are key aspects in different communities that appear to be making them more or less attractive to young people. Some of those things clearly are, for young people, 25 to 29-year-olds, is what kind of rental housing is there available. And it's affordable, but it's not just affordability. Is there rental housing that is high enough quality, that's near amenities, the kinds of things that younger folks want to be around, the social amenities, the ability to interact with other young people, cultural, civic amenities. Are there good restaurants? Are there places to gather? Those kinds of things. So a place like Portsmouth or my community where I live in Dover have got that in spades. And so they're attracting more of a young, despite the fact that they're both pretty high cost areas. So the policies that communities can enact to do this, one, they have to allow rental housing. And the closer to the downtown, the better, the higher the density, so they can lots of younger people can aggregate. That's all things that are within the control of communities. There's some communities that simply have none of that. If you look at communities that are adding younger people, they're communities that have, by and large, a higher percentage of rental housing and quality rental housing and near their downtown core. One, they have to have a downtown core to have that. But those are the things that communities can do. So it's under their control more than the state's control.
Brian, in terms of those communities that are seeing that influx, is it more south central, southeastern part of the state, or is there any migration to the northern part of the state?
You know, it's really interesting because, for the most part, you're right, it is in the southern part of the state and the southeast. The seacoast area in particular has been a magnet. And by the way, the seacoast was a magnet even during the worst of the out-migration. The seacoast area still managed to attract more people into the region than out of the region. So it's for the most part, been communities in the seacoast region who tend to have that mix of amenities and housing that we talk. But we're also starting to see it in a place like Concord, you know. But most interestingly, from my perspective, is if you look at Littleton, New Hampshire. Look at how that community, and I track aging of communities over several decades. They've seen an influx of that younger group, that younger demographic, the 25 to 29-year-olds, or 25 to 34, and that's in the North Country. So it's not impossible. I mean, you know, it's harder because the opportunities, economic opportunities aren't there, but it can be done, and it starts first, from my perspective, looking at the community yourself, not looking to the state to answer these questions, but looking to the community.
In the past, when New Hampshire has been able to pull in that particular demographic, have you found the trend is that they stay, that they build a family and a community here and never leave? And what do you see for this most recent trend?
Yeah, generally when people move here, they stay here. I mean, you know, anecdotally, there's plenty of people who come here, stay for years and then leave. But by and large, you know, once people come to New Hampshire and they stay. I mean, our core demographic, again, has been the married couple family with kids. We tend to import our children instead of having, you know, higher birth rates. That demographic isn't moving around a lot. Now, when you're talking about, you know, recent college graduates, younger demographic, the 25 to 29-year-olds, you know, demographic trends today mean likely that they're not with children, so they could conceivably be, you know, more mobile. They're also the people that we attract, by the way, tend to be really well educated. About 57% of the people that we attract over the last 5 years or so have had some post-secondary degree, and over 40%, about 44 or 45%, have a BA or higher. So we attract young people who are well educated. They're mobile, so we have to offer them something in order to get them to stay, because they could probably get a job in a lot of places. My experience in looking, and it's hard to ferret this out from the data, is that generally when we get people here, they like it enough that they tend to stay. Not everybody, but we have a pretty good capture rate.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to economist Brian Gottlob discussing New Hampshire's demographic trends and some of the changes recently. Now I want to switch gears, Brian, to perhaps, I guess I'll characterize the New Hampshire demographic trends as, until recently, pretty alarmist. And perhaps federal fiscal policy would fall into that same category. It's something we talk about a lot. And you had been writing this fall and winter on some trends in federal revenues, particularly when it comes to the tax code overhaul. In fact, one piece that jumped out at me was something you wrote, I think it was even in December, maybe November, about a Treasury report that indicated that we had seen the largest deficit in November in the nation's history. And you mentioned that that was a cyclical trend and that, you know, every month has an ebb and flow to it. But was there something about November on an annual basis that makes that important to you, or was it just the latest factual figures that you had?
It was the latest factual figures that we had, but I can tell you that trend, if you pick another month, is very similar. I picked November because it was the most recent, and it was so dramatic. You know, the fall off in year-over-year revenues was so dramatic. But if you look at October or you look at September, go back, it's a trend, and it's a trend that's been, unfortunately, growing. You know, there's one good thing about the current government shutdown is that they're not producing those deficit numbers, because I look every day and say, I go to the Treasury Department, and they have what they call the monthly Treasury statement, and that's where I get my data. And November is the last month that they've reported. So they're kind of keeping the bad news from us.
Yeah.
But yeah, the trend is disturbing year over year. And I've heard people say that, oh, revenues are as high as they've ever been. Well, that may be true, but our economy is much bigger as well.
Yeah.
They're just not growing. Yeah. And in fact, some of them are falling off pretty dramatically.
And to that point, we've seen pretty steady economic growth coming out of the Great Recession, yet we're seeing still massive budget deficits. So, and that's something you wrote about as well. Why is that a concern to you?
It's extremely concerning. And I think we've had deficits, and we've had big deficits for a while. Why I think this situation is more concerning and more dramatic is the fact that we're running very large deficits at a time when the economy has had really good growth over the last couple of years. You know, typically, federal fiscal policy is countercyclical, meaning when the economy is strong, we collect a lot of revenues, and we kind of try to use that at times when the economy isn't weaker. We fill our coffers, or try to, when the economy is good. And certainly at the state level, that's the case. This is different because we've got an economy that is not going to get better. I don't think you'll find many. Well, you may find a few who hopefully and who are arguing the impact of the tax cuts are saying that it will get better. Likely not. So we're facing a situation where the economy will be weaker at the very same time when revenues have been weak. So if the economy gets weaker, then what's going to happen to revenues? They're really going to plummet. Why is that concerning? Because when the economy weakens, we usually use fiscal policy to help offset that weakness. That countercyclical. We spend a little bit more government money, or sometimes a lot more government money, like the Great Recession, in order to offset some of the lack of demand in the private sector.
And one thing you mentioned was, in your writing, that having such growing deficits in a time of economic growth can make it difficult to respond to the next economic downfall.
Right.
Give me some examples as how it becomes more difficult there.
Well, because Congress, Senate, and the House, they're really constrained. They'll be facing what looks like very soon, maybe not this year, but likely next year at least, $1 trillion annual deficit. When an economy turns down and hits typically a period of recession, then the government usually spends a little bit more. It does things like lowers the payroll tax, or it does things like offers some sort of rebate on taxes. And those are the things. George Bush did that. President Obama has done that. Those are stimulative things that cost the government money, expand our deficit. It's going to be hard to do that, or harder to do that, when we're going to be threatened with, one, higher deficits, and two, likely higher interest rates. The cost of servicing, you know, we'll have to borrow to fund these deficits. And while we've been really lucky on interest rates thus far, that won't last forever. So the cost of the debt will be much higher. So we don't have the tools. Is basically, we won't have the tools. We won't have the spending tools and the Federal Reserve, because interest rates are still really low. Typically, when we go into recession, the Federal Reserve will lower interest rates by at least 200-300 basis points or more, as many as 400 basis points, you know, from 4%, 3%. Well, we're at a little over 2% now. We can't do that, so we don't have the tools.
I think in the past, most experts look at the growing budget deficit and they'll oftentimes blame it on spending, how it's expected to grow at a much more rapid rate than revenue generation or even economic growth. And that's probably still the case, but I think something that has made matters worse, from my view, is the latest tax cut. From what I can see, it hasn't generated the level of revenue that many economists that supported it thought it would. And I'm curious what your take is. Explain your view on the 2017 tax cut and its impact on the economy and revenue generation.
Yeah. Well, one, up front, it has had a stimulative impact. When you cut taxes on individuals and businesses, you do have a stimulative effect. So it has added to the growth level of the economy. That's a good thing. I would have argued that it wasn't needed. We were on a good growth path. So we're losing revenue at a time when we probably didn't need to lose revenue. So the impact of the tax cut, I think most dramatically has been felt in the corporate sector, where tax rates were lowered from 35% down to 21%. So what has been the impact of that? Well, if you talk to those who supported that measure, they argued that a couple things would happen. There'd be this tremendous boom in investment, and two, that it would generate more revenue than it would lose. Well, the evidence on both of those is not particularly strong, that either of those things have happened. One, year over year, corporate tax revenues are down by about 30%. Now, we did see a little bit of an increase in business investment, but not a lot. And I'm surprised that a lot of economists argued that there'd be a boom in investment. One, businesses don't invest unless there's profitable investments to make. And when we're at later in an economic cycle, we've been on a good growth path for a number of years, there are fewer of those clear opportunities for investment. So investment hasn't been that strong. And in fact, in a lot of categories, it's non-residential investment has been down or just barely above zero increase over the previous year. And a lot of the growth has been in one particular sector, and that's oil and gas. So the energy market has played a bigger role probably in tax cuts. So what we're getting is, for that huge tax cut on corporate, and by the way, I was in favor of cutting corporate taxes. I just think that we could have done it differently, more gradually, and at a time when maybe the economy is weaker, when it would have had more of a stimulative effect. So the bottom line is, it's not having the effect. All those who argued that it would have this boom in revenue and boom in investment have been pretty silent recently. I mean, they're making a pretty weak case that those things have happened. So we're just adding to the deficit without adding a lot to the economy.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Brian Gottlob discuss New Hampshire demographic trends as well as federal fiscal policy. Thank you for joining the show, Brian.
Great to be here, Chase.
Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby will join me to discuss challenges presented by population growth changes and provide an update on the partial government shutdown. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby. Bob is a regular contributor on Facing the Future. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be back, Chase.
It is a very cold day in New Hampshire, and from what I gather, it's pretty cold in Washington where you are right now. So I think we should heat up the show with a conversation about a topic that has stayed in the news for the past month, and that is the current ongoing partial government shutdown. Before we dive into any details there, you can give us a quick summary of where we are and maybe even how we got here in this now. I think it's over 30 days long in a government shutdown.
Just as a recap, the federal government operates on 12 annual appropriation bills that fund various departments and agencies of the government, and things were going along pretty well this year, unusually well. Five of the bills actually passed on time, and those five bills covered about 75% of the agency bills. That's not 75% of the budget, because there's a lot of mandatory spending programs that Social Security and Medicare and that sort of thing. But of the appropriated bills, programs, Congress was able to fund about 75%. So that's why people refer to this as a partial shutdown. There's like 25% of federal spending is stuck in the remaining seven bills which have not passed. And they're actually all being held hostage, you might say, to a fight over the one bill, the Homeland Security Agency bill, which has funding for a border wall. So if you think about this, there is a dispute over one relatively small section of one relatively small bill, but it packaged together with these other six bills, which fund a lot of other programs like the Justice Department and the Commerce Department and Interior Department. There are a lot of agencies that are closed that have nothing to do with border security, and that's why a lot of the government is shut down.
So, Bob, why can't the government just open, get those other six of seven bills passed, and focus on border security and homeland security after they've tackled those other issues? Why isn't there any headway being made there?
It's inexplicable. I mean, the only answer is, frankly, not a good one. There really is no reason for it. I mean, if they're at loggerheads over the homeland security bill, they should release the rest of the bills, send the people back to work so they get paid, and the government is functioning, and continue to fight over the Homeland Security bill. The only reason that they don't do it is because, quite frankly, it does give the president more leverage to... It is like hostage-taking. I mean, it's just like, you know, I've got these other bills, and I'm not going to let them go until you give me the wall. Yeah, like I say, the only reason that makes any sense is not a very positive one.
And from what I've heard in the news, it almost seems like both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are making gestures or proposals that are more politically motivated than solutions oriented. And you've mentioned the word hostage a couple times when it comes to this process and the Homeland Security bill sort of holding up everything else. What's a path forward? I know we had you and Diane Lim on the show last week talking about how it's probably going to take some public outrage, a higher level of it, to get us over the hump on this issue. But it seems like we've got a fair amount of public outrage and the needle hasn't moved at all. So are we at this point having to shoot the hostage and move on? Like, what is a path forward in your view?
I do think that it's going to require even more public outrage, which could well come through virtual airport closures. TSA workers, if they staged a strike, which might technically be illegal, but you know, you could really ground the U.S. commerce to a halt, and that would certainly provide some outrage. I think federal workers missing a second paycheck is going to ratchet things up, but it hasn't ratcheted up yet to that point where it's enough to break the logjam, so it might take another couple of weeks or so. I mean, I hate to say it, but I just, you know, both sides seem to think that they are going to win the public's approval for what they're doing, or they're appealing to their base, and until that calculation changes, I feel very, very bad for the federal workers who are innocent victims of this.
Bob, this particular government shutdown is now the longest in U.S. history, and it's actually double the length already of the most recent shutdown in 2013. And there have been several shutdowns over the course of our history. So generally, what tends to bring those shutdowns to an end?
Well, I distinguish between there are little mini shutdowns, kind of tremors, and then there are big shutdowns that are more like earthquakes. And this is one of the bigger ones, obviously. It's the biggest one that we've had. Among the bigger ones, the smaller ones are just usually just like minor things that they shut down for a couple of hours, and then they manage to pass a bill and keep things going. They just basically ran out of time to make an agreement. But on the major ones, the big earthquake-type ones, usually it's some faction holding out for a particular result in the budget that they think is so important that it's worth shutting down the rest of the government for. You know, whether it was the Republicans in 95, they wanted to have big cuts in Medicare when they came into office, and the Clinton administration resisted it, and they just had a big showdown. 2013, there was a showdown over whether or not to repeal Obamacare, this one, of course, being about the border wall. The other ones have been about bigger issues in terms of, you know, fundamental impact on the budget, whether you're talking about Medicare or Obamacare versus a wall, which, whatever you think of it, is a very, very small part of the budget. But usually what turns it in the end is public revulsion. And the party that is trying to get its way by, you know, holding its breath and stomping its feet and saying, you know, you have to do what we do or we're gonna shut everything down, usually that doesn't play well after a while. It just gets on people's nerves. And so I think this shutdown will probably end the same way. Now, there's probably going to have to be some face-saving device all the way around, some way that Trump can claim that he's pursuing his campaign promise of a wall and Democrats to say we did not give him a wall. So I have long thought that the answer here lies in clever semantics. And you're seeing a little bit of that happening now with Trump making some statements about things he would be willing to accept and Democrats putting some things forward in terms of border security. So even though it doesn't look like there's much going on, I do think that the ice is beginning to crack a little bit here. And some clever people maybe could come up with a way of saying that there's money here, there's a virtual wall. Trump just, in effect, declaring victory by the wording and the Democrats also declaring victory, and both sides agreeing to disagree on who won and go forward.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. We're discussing the current ongoing government shutdown. And Bob, one thing that you've mentioned in the past that we haven't really talked about today was the potential that the president would move beyond just face-saving semantics and go so far as to make an emergency declaration as it pertains to our southern border. Do you think that's something that's a reality? Would you advise against it? What's your take on that kind of approach that the president could ultimately pursue?
Well, I think he might well do that. That's one of the things that people have described as an off-ramp. I think that I wrote a blog last week about how the off-ramp was closed for construction. I don't think it's a good idea. The idea, but the genesis of the idea, pushed by some people on the president's side, including, I think, Lindsey Graham has mentioned this, is, look, we're at loggerheads here, so why don't we just declare an emergency, say that the president has emergency powers to fund the wall and let the courts decide, and we'll move on. And it does have a certain surface appeal to it, like pushing a panic button, just starting over again. But it has, in my view, some real serious problems in terms of the precedent it would set, its legality, and its practicality. I think it's really of dubious legality. For one thing, let's start with the premise the president has no authority to appropriate funds. He cannot spend a dime that hasn't been approved by Congress. You start with that. And what he does have the authority to do is rearrange some money that's already been approved and say, well, I'm going to spend it for a different purpose than Congress intended because there's an emergency and there's some So there are certain statutes that give the president, under certain circumstances, authority to do that. Usually those statutes are intended to apply to assist ongoing military operations, like construction facilities or something like that overseas. Using it domestically for a construction purpose like this would be unprecedented. I think it would be a misuse, if not an abuse, of presidential power to do that. And so there are a lot of Republicans who, you know, believe in limited government and limited powers that fought the Obama administration on exercise of administrative authorities. I think have expressed to the president their reluctance to go along with an emergency. He doesn't have enough money available under emergency powers to actually build a wall. He might be able to get $5 billion, but it's going to take 25 to, I've heard, as much as $60 billion to actually construct the thing. So it's not a sound source of actually finishing the wall, and I think it would lead to permanent shutdowns. I mean, we talk about a partial shutdown now. Congress would react by saying they're putting a provision in every single appropriation bill from here on out that said the president shall not use any money herein provided, you know, for emergency purposes to build a wall on the border. He wouldn't sign such bills. The Republicans probably wouldn't pass them in the Senate. And so instead of having a partial shutdown by the end of the fiscal year, September 30th, we'd have a full shutdown. I don't think it's a very good option, and it's not the magic bullet, some think.
Talking about the issue of a border wall, sort of underlying or wrapped up in all of this is the topic and issue of immigration. And that takes me to a report that came out and some analysis of it by the Brookings Institute. But the Census Bureau reported that population growth has continued to trend downward. I guess my question to you would be, are issue experts viewing immigration as a potential solution to population growth? Do they think it's an issue that should be addressed? Are there other implications, like if our population is aging and not growing very quickly, perhaps Social Security and Medicare are impacted?
As the Census Bureau is telling us, the U.S. is, you know, population growth is slowing, and that is having an effect, will have an effect on the future on economic growth. And what we need is, frankly, more people as a society ages and the economy is matures like ours has. We're a so-called developed nation. We do need to have a steady supply of new workers to be able to keep the economy growing. And the alarming thing about the census report is that our population, as the population slows to a halt in terms of growth, that will have long-term effects on the economy. Meanwhile, the big debate right now is not how to bring in new workers that we need, but how to keep them out with, of all things, a wall. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, I have long thought that we should be having a discussion about reforming immigration that would bring in more people into this country. You could do that, hypothetically, and still build a wall. You don't need, I mean, we can have a discussion about border security, which I think most people would agree with, and still confront this population problem that we have, you know, by increasing the number of legal immigrants. So we tend not to have nuanced debates in this country, and it's, you know, right now we're having a very polarizing debate. It's all about whether or not to build a wall. What we should be having is a much broader discussion about immigration policy and how we should have border security and at the same time be open to bringing in many more people to fill jobs that are going unfilled right now.
Bob, last question before we have to go here. I want to see if you could paint us two different pictures here. What would it be like trying to address issues in the federal budget like Social Security and Medicare cost growth and the population implications there when not factoring in a growth in immigration versus actively using immigration to help prop up or correct those particular programs?
Well, the Social Security Administration assumes basically a constant level of immigration, and they assume actually a level of illegal immigration because one of the dirty little secrets is illegal immigrants actually help prop up the Social Security system because they pay payroll taxes and they're never going to collect benefits because they're not eligible. The fiscal future, including for the entitlement programs, would look very much worse if we lowered legal immigration, as some have proposed, and it would look better if we increased legal immigration. It's not a cure. I mean, you can't, you know, say let's have so many new workers come in that you'll have so much new payroll tax that you'll cure the Social Security problem. That's not feasible, because the new people that come in legally are eventually going to qualify for benefits as well. So you would, yeah, you get a big upfront hit for Social Security, which would look great in the budget, but eventually you'd have to pay benefits for them, so it's not a magic bullet. If we go to a system that would cut legal immigration, all of these problems would look worse.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and Bob Bixby discuss the nation's longest government shutdown, as well as some demographic and population growth trends as reported by the Census Bureau and some analysis by the Brookings Institute. Thank you for joining the show once again, Bob.
Okay, thanks, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Once this partial government shutdown comes to an end and the border wall issue is resolved one way or another, even bigger challenges await. As budgetary gridlock on Capitol Hill worsens, so does the federal budget deficit. With all the attention being paid to the partial government shutdown over funding for a wall on the Mexican border, it is easy to forget that up until the end of the fiscal year in September, the appropriations process was going fairly well. Five of the 12 annual appropriations bills passed on time, funding about 75% of the agency's budgets. Aside from the wall, which is holding up funding for the Department of Homeland Security, there is not much controversy over the remaining seven appropriations bills. However, when the border wall issue is eventually resolved, even bigger challenges await. Not only is the deficit projected to exceed $1 trillion in the next fiscal year, up from $973 billion projected for this year alone, but the caps on discretionary spending are scheduled to decline by about 10%. In other words, unless there is some new agreement to raise the caps, as has happened three times since the caps were enacted in 2011, Congress will have less money than it had this year to spend on these programs. That means less money for domestic programs that House Democrats will want and less money for defense spending that Republican lawmakers and President Trump will want. So if appropriations bills were hard to pass with a $1.2 trillion cap in fiscal year 2019, it is safe to assume that they will be even more difficult to pass when the cap goes down to $1.1 trillion in fiscal year 2020. Moreover, as we're seeing with the current shutdown over the semantics of border security, policy differences can be just as problematic as funding issues. Unwillingness to make hard choices is what led to declining budget caps in the first place. A special, quote, supercommittee in 2011 was supposed to come up with $1.2 trillion to $1.5 trillion in deficit reduction. If the committee failed, discretionary spending programs would be capped through fiscal year 2021 at a level of $1.2 trillion below what was projected at the time. This was to be enforced by an automatic across-the-board cut known as sequestration. The theory behind sequestration was that the cuts would be so painful that lawmakers would avoid them by making politically difficult policy changes to taxes and large mandatory spending programs such as Social Security and Medicare. But this theory proved to be entirely incorrect. First, policymakers allowed the cuts to go into effect in March of 2013. Then, in subsequent years, as the cuts grew deeper and more painful, policymakers simply raised spending above the sequester cap level, sometimes offsetting the increased spending by relying on budget gimmicks. The most recent agreement raised the caps for fiscal years 2018 and 2019. We're in fiscal year 2019 right now. The caps will spring back to life, however, in fiscal year 2020, which is the year the new Congress will turn its attention to when this year's delayed process is completed and the current shutdown is resolved. Meanwhile, the deficit has resumed an upward path. Current projections by the Congressional Budget Office show the deficit rising above $1 trillion in every year beyond 2019,
reaching $1.5 trillion by 2028. Because fiscal policy is on an unsustainable track under current law, even if the old caps go into effect, gridlock will mean higher deficits. And if Congress reaches an agreement to raise the caps and fails to find legitimate offsets, these projected deficits will increase. All of this leaves out the political clashes likely to take place over taxes and mandatory spending programs. Newly empowered House Democrats may seek to expand those programs, while the President and Senate Republicans may keep pushing for more tax cuts. So, for all those who will be tempted to breathe a sigh of relief when the border wall fight is finally resolved, think again. Our fiscal problems run far deeper, and one thing is certain. Mexico is not going to pay for the debts we are racking up any more than it's going to pay for a wall. It's time to get serious about the real fiscal crisis. The President and Congress need to resolve the current standoff, move on to a longer-term deal on spending caps, and address the structural gap between mandatory spending and revenues. Anything less will just be passing the buck. Again. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.